You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, November 18th. 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Seether, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Sam Quiñones, author of The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Meanwhile, the House will begin debate on the Build Back Better social spending bill today. And information from the almighty CBO score keeps trickling out, and it's looking like the child care and universal pre-K programs may actually cost less than expected. So Manchin should be running out of excuses.
It's time for a new excuse.
Yeah, he'll find some more.
Constitution.
Some more inflation. The Senate has advanced the bloated NDAA, despite objections and no votes from Sanders, Warren, Booker, and Markey. Weird that, you know, no votes from the libertarian types like Mike Lee and Rand Paul, huh? So they will pair it with a China competitiveness bill. So extra funds for the Pentagon with a side of Cold War propaganda just for kicks. The House has formally sanctioned Representative Paul Gosar for the anime edit he tweeted out, which depicted him killing AOC and attacking Biden. Just two Republicans joined Democrats in voting yes, Liz Cheney and Adam Hinziger. There was one Republican who voted present, but Julius Jones, a black man sentenced to death, is set to be executed today, despite serious doubts about his guilt. He'll be executed unless Oklahoma's Republican governor stays the execution. More on that at the top of the show after this. Two of the three men convicted of killing Malcolm X in 1965 have been exonerated after spending two decades in prison. The Manhattan DA's investigation found that the FBI and NYPD, shocker, withheld evidence that likely would have led to their acquittal. But DA's investigation did not release more materials about the FBI's involvement, however, huh? Might want to know a little bit more about that.
Or just move on.
Yeah. And lastly, I should say, if you work in the DA's office and you want to release those materials to the media, please do. And lastly, the over 10,000 John Deere workers that were striking have ratified a new 6-year contract after walking off the job in mid-October. They declined the first two offers. This is the third. Wages will be raised and payment ceilings for performance will be raised as well as giving workers a traditional pension. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. We have a great show for you today. Sam is out on Thursdays, but I am here to hold down the fort and, you know, do a little bit of the stories that I think are most important, lead with those. This Julius Jones case, I feel like, you know, maybe we dropped the ball a little bit and not talking about it more, given the fact that he is set to be executed at 4 p.m. today. For people who are unfamiliar, Julius Jones was convicted when he was 19 years old. Republican Kevin Still is the governor in Oklahoma, and there have been repeated calls on him to stay this execution. So Jones was sentenced to death around 20 years ago for the murder of Paul Howell, who was a white man. It was an attempted carjacking. Paul was killed, and the family of this man continue to claim that this is the right person, Julius Jones, even though his daughters are speaking out. They were children at the time, but they are convinced that it is him and that he should be executed, which, by the way, you know, people say, oh, if you had a family member who was murdered, you'd want to kill that person and beat them to death with their bare hands. That's not always the case. I mean, I just watched this documentary about the victims of Ted Bundy, and a lot of the families of those victims, they felt uncomfortable by the idea of the death penalty, as you should.
Yeah, well, and it's also why we have law.
Yeah.
Like, we don't that's not how it works. But also, I would recommend people watch The Confession Killer. It's a Netflix documentary about Henry Lee Lucas, who confessed to hundreds of murders in the 80s. Basically, what happened was the Texas Rangers were using him to close any murder cases that they couldn't solve. And police departments from across the country started getting in on that action, too.
Mm-hmm.
And the families literally came to believe that he was responsible, and that they looked at him as the image of, you know, what ruined their lives. And it's hard to come away from that reality. But
Become an avatar for your grief.
Exactly.
And that's, I think, what seemingly is happening in this case. So there was a co-defendant in this case. Again, Julius Jones, this was 20 years ago. He was 19 at the time. And the co-defendant named Chris Jordan told three cellmates, according to their sworn testimony, that he was the one that committed the murder. There were also discrepancies in the identification of Jones. He had a shaved head at the time, and the witness said that the assailant had 1 to 2 inches of hair, was wearing a bandana. So, I mean, there's
reasonable doubt, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasonable doubt, and that's enough. I mean, there's more evidence in Jones's favor, but even the Oklahoma Parole Board, who, you know, they're not liberal, lefty, Innocence Project types, who is, you know, the Innocence Project is involved in trying to stop this execution. They recommended that his sentence be changed to life in prison so that they could stay the execution, because they believe there's enough doubt in this case. This is why we should not have executions in this country. It's only there to satisfy the bloodlust for about half of our population. Honestly, this is, you know, the death penalty is still more popular than it should be, because as a law, there are always you have to make sure that the law is applied equally and that it's just. And there are always going to be people that fall through the cracks like this who probably did not commit this crime. There's also evidence that one juror reportedly referred to Jones by the N-word and said he should be taken behind the courthouse and shot during the trial. Obviously, overwhelmingly, the jury was white. 11 of the 12 jurors were white. And there were reports that the cop, when arresting him, referred to him by the N-word. There have been growing protests in this case. Celebrities like Baker Mayfield, weirdly, who's kind of conservative, has spoken out about this. But I think it's because of his OU connection. But Kim Kardashian, who's been involved in trying to exonerate these people, has spoken out about this. 1,800 Oklahoma students in 13 schools walked out yesterday in protest, and there were demonstrations at the state capitol like this one.
And just to cite there, that was from, who was that Twitter handle that was cut off in the, Tyreek Baker.
Yes.
CBT.
And then there's also this powerful footage here that I want to show you of a pastor who chained himself to the fence outside the Oklahoma State Capitol building. He offered his life in Julius's place, and I think everybody should. You're going to watch it because I'm going to play it, but it's important to watch.
Over and over again, we killed the innocent. The time has come to stop killing people. I have offered, if the governor wants to simply kill another black man, who cares what black man it is? I've offered to die in place of Julius Jones and asked the governor if he would allow me to lie on that table and allow Julius Jones to go free. The time has come for a country occupied by intelligent people to stop killing in the name of justice. It is not justice, and it is not just. The way the laws of capital punishment are applied in the United States disproportionately impact people who look like me, people of color, people who do not come from families of wealth. I am here calling upon Governor Stitt to do the right thing. We've been told that he's waiting on a word from God regarding this matter. Who among us would think that God would say, okay, Governor, kill this man, when the Board of Pardons and Parole has suggested on more than one occasion that he be granted clemency? I'm here to help the governor make up his mind to set Julius Jones free or to grant him clemency. The man has been in prison half his life for a crime he says he did not commit, and others say he did not commit. That's why I'm here.
It's incredibly powerful. Pastor Marvin Morgan from Virginia. We know statistically that there's over 1%, maybe 4% is the figure that sticks out in my mind, of death row inmates are innocent. And one person executed wrongly is too many. And that disproportionately falls on black people, as the pastor said there.
Like, even then, like, other countries have gotten rid of this, right? Like, without that, like, oh, look at it's, and maybe that, like, what worries me is, like, are we such a brutal country that, like, our racism and the reason we still have the death penalty are, like, part of the same thing, right? Because, like, Europe has got rid of this. Like, and to me...
But that's what he says there, right? Right, exactly. He says, if you want to kill a black man, take me instead. I mean, that's not going to happen, but the power of that gesture is important to point out.
Like, I don't understand how people can be pro-death penalty. Like, it's just the myopicness of, I think, people in America. Like, look around you. Think through it, like, logically.
That's what I'm trying to do.
Killing people. Yeah. No, exactly. Like, but people, we just don't do it here, and it's really depressing.
Yeah, exactly. I think what you point out, the death penalty as an extension of our systemic racism, is important, because no one's ever going to say it. And, you know, the governor of Oklahoma, Kevin Stitt, is not going to say it. But implicit in these people's thoughts are, well, he was probably doing something bad anyway. It's okay.
Yeah, it's like, who cares?
Who cares, right? Yeah, right? Exactly. He's not one of us. So who cares?
And it's like, you look at Australia, similar, like, British penal colony type of stuff, abolished the death penalty. Like, there's something about America, and, like, people commented on this for the entirety of our history, that we're, like, brutal and don't care about particularly certain human lives.
Yes. It's, like, part of this cowboy mentality, too, right? A conquer mentality.
Yeah, or, like, the burn the witch mentality.
Or that, too. That's as old as America. All right, we're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, we are going to be joined by Sam Quiñones, author of The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. We'll be right back. We are back, and we are joined right now by Sam Quiñones, author of The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Sam, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on your show.
I'm really excited for our conversation because your last book, Dreamland, I mean, it really, I think, gave people a lot of the language that they needed to talk about the opioid crisis today, right? I mean, you were kind of prescient in that way in your reporting going across the country. Maybe we can even just start there because so much of really even the first part of your book shows how omnipresent opioids are and how the opioid epidemic, not understanding the opioid epidemic does not allow you to truly understand the current fentanyl crisis, of course, but also how this country is relating to meth right now. So let's just start there.
Well, sure. I mean, what the opioid epidemic did was create a new population of opioid addicted folks, Americans, all across the country because it was promulgated by pharmaceutical companies who pressuring doctors to prescribe. And doctors were all over the country, and doctors all over the country bought into the idea that they could now prescribe narcotic painkillers, morphine, but also branded ones, Vicodin, Percocet, of course, OxyContin, without any risk of running of addiction for those folks who were pain patients. This idea was not supported by science, but nevertheless was essentially accepted, taught in medical schools, et cetera. And so over about a 15 to so year period, we saw this enormous increase in supply all across the country from prescriptions, from doctors prescribing to people. And then, of course, a lot of that leaked out into the black market, and you found black market for pills in pretty much every region of the country. They were expensive on the street, $1 a milligram usually. Folks were up to that point by doing 150, 200 milligrams a day. They couldn't sustain that. And when they did, they switched to heroin. And when they did that, the Mexican trafficking world, which had really ignored heroin for a long time, sat up and took notice and began trafficking that. That population has existed, continues, and continues actually to grow. And that population is really probably the first driver of the folks who are using fentanyl. And the reason traffickers in Mexico figured out fentanyl was they saw, gee, this is a growing population. It's so much cheaper, easier, less risk. We don't need land to make synthetic drugs like fentanyl instead of growing poppies, that kind of thing. And so that's kind of what led us into the fentanyl issue that we're dealing with today, and the methamphetamine as well.
Yeah. So what was the difference that you really saw when your book Dreamland came out in 2015? And fentanyl is just everywhere now. I mean,
right.
How stark was it when it, in comparing your research for your first book with your current book?
It's a radically different scene. What is the same, though, is an interesting thing, that the supply of drugs is almost comparable. And when with the pharmaceuticals, painkillers, you saw just an amazing coverage, you know, West Coast to East Coast, really intensely in some states, certainly, particularly in the Midwest and Maine, New Mexico, Oregon, various places like that. But nevertheless, you found them all over the country. And now we've seen the underworld take over that role. The doctors have stepped back. Pharmaceutical companies are chastened, and you're not seeing the heavy promotion, sales force promotion that you used to see for narcotic painkillers. And doctors' offices is nearly as much as you used to, barely at all, I think. And so now, but we opened that Pandora's box. We created that consumer market with that enormous supply of pills. And then the underworlds stepped in. And when they did, they made a transition. They were already in the middle of, but really with a vengeance, again, switching from plant-based drugs, which the Mexican trafficking world had grown up on, marijuana, poppies, et cetera, away from that really towards synthetics. And the main ones being fentanyl and methamphetamine now. So this, it's a fascinating switch because there's a totally different source for what we see on the streets today, but the coverage is remarkably similar. So complete, you know, on the entire country. Something we've never really seen before is a homogenization of the drug offering all across the country. Very much like what you see when you go across country, drive across country on the interstates. You see the same hotels, the same Burger Kings and McDonald's, the same gas stations, et cetera, et cetera. It's almost like they mimic corporate America in that, and that the same offering in New Mexico as in LA, as in Vermont, as in Columbus, Ohio.
And that's got to be, I guess, that's connected to the synthetic nature of it, right? I mean, let's talk a little bit about how, I mean, you touched on it there, but what I found so fascinating in your book was how the synthetic nature of these drugs change the supply chain as well. And then, yeah, of course, it makes it a lot easier to spread because the quantities are so small and so easily smuggable, particularly in fentanyl's case, but meth's always been synthetic, but the fact that there is this infrastructure for synthetic drug use probably allows for greater meth sales as well.
Yeah, the synthetic thing allows for the supplies that we're seeing today. So with synthetic drugs, you no longer need land. You no longer need rainfall, seasons, a large cadre of farm workers and harvesters and all that stuff. All you really need, you don't need land. What you need is shipping ports. And there are two shipping ports that are very important in the story on the western side of Mexico, Pacific Coast, and near the drug producing regions, Sinaloa, Michoacan, those areas, and the drug, the chemicals. So shipping ports allow you access to the world chemical markets. And those chemicals have been coming in really in like container load quantities for several years now. Synthetic drugs also allow you to avoid seasons. The reason we've never seen this kind of supply before from, say, cocaine, really, or marijuana, for example, is that these things take a long time to grow. These plants take a long time to grow and they require certain seasons. With meth and fentanyl, you can make them all year round so long as you have the chemicals, which they do. And so seasons no longer matter. All they really need are these chemicals. And what we're seeing now is just a result of that. It's like stunning, staggering quantities of this stuff coming through the ports into Mexico, and then from Mexico, it's made into the dope, and it's coming across into the United States and changing a lot about drug trafficking now. It's a remarkable all the different ways that you're seeing. It's really democratized drug, certainly fentanyl. Now anybody can be a kingpin.
Right? Yeah.
Used to be that you needed that if you were a drug dealer on the street, one of your main concerns was, where am I going to get my dope? And people were always being arrested, sent to jail. You lose your connection, that kind of thing. That has been solved. The supply problem solves the dealer's main issue about where am I going. Now the big issue is, where do I sell all this stuff that I can get my hands on constantly all around me?
You tell a lot of stories in your book about, you know, many different people that you spoke to, including a duo in China manufacturing fentanyl. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's a great example of anybody can create fentanyl now.
Well, they were like, I didn't really speak to them, but they're part of a major case. And there's a lot on these folks, the Zhang father and son. And they went online by the name of Gordon Jin. They were really part, I think, mostly of the first wave of fentanyl that was in which chemical companies in China were providing straight fentanyl through the mails to folks here in the United States who saw it as like their lottery ticket. Oh, my God, I can get this stuff. I can make, you know, huge, huge profits. And they were one of the first ones they had numerous, there are numerous cases involving the Zhangs or Gordon Jin as the name they use, all across this country. Now they've been indicted and all, and they're not leaving China. So there's no way of getting them over here, but their story was an interesting one because it just showed you, these guys were like country folk. The dad certainly seems like he was like a kind of a janitor, I think, for a while, but it shows you who can get rich. That, although has changed now. The Chinese no longer are sending fentanyl over in the mail. In fact, the supplies that we're seeing on the street now aren't really possible, never were possible when China was sending this stuff over in the mail. You just don't get to tons and tons and tons of this stuff the way we're seeing it now without if it's coming through the U.S. mail. It just doesn't arrive. It can't arrive in the quantities that we're seeing now coming up from Mexico, because that switched. It went from China producing it to China providing the ingredients and the Mexicans making it. That's what really accounts for the enormous quantities. They're right on our border. We have free trade with Mexico. We have millions of cars and trucks back and forth all the time. Our law enforcement doesn't have nearly enough time to check, I think, more than 5 or 10% of those things coming across. And so that's the way it's getting through our major border crossings, Tijuana, San Diego, Juarez, El Paso, those kinds of places. That would not have happened had the Chinese continued to just provide it via the mail.
What strikes me is how this new synthetic surge kind of reflects and adapts to our global capitalist structure, right? I mean, like, we're talking about supply chains right now and these backlogs in the United States and how that's contributing to inflation or what have you. I mean, a lot of this is raw material in China,
yes,
going to Mexico, and then the free trade agreements shipping to the United States. It's working within the very confines that, like, our neoliberal structure, frankly, has allowed.
And I think that's one of the other interesting things, that absolutely true what you just said. And one of the other interesting things is that the traffickers in Mexico, you know, they grew up, the pioneers in all this were farmers, ranchers, unlettered folks, pretty simple folks, quick with a gun, but, you know, not too sophisticated, and never could have imagined themselves trading for chemicals in China or India or Hong Kong or wherever, you know. And now, of course, that's what being a drug trafficker really means. You're now a global trader in so many ways. And so, and that's what we're seeing now. It's because they're getting access to the efficiencies provided by the global economy of getting the chemicals from someplace, making it another place, shipping it to a third place. I mean, it's like any automotive supply chain almost.
Right. I guess I wanted to, I mean, we've mostly touched on fentanyl. I do want to get to meth, but I just find this so fascinating. I was not fully aware of the history of fentanyl, and one, I mean, how important it was for surgical procedures in its, when used correctly. Talk a little bit about its correct usage and then, of course, how it got duplicated by people trying to make it for recreational use.
Well, it was invented in 1960 by Paul Janssen, one of the brilliant minds, scientific minds of the 20th century, I think, in this world. And he invented this. It revolutionized surgery. All of us have benefited from fentanyl just by the way surgery is now able to be done far more safely. I had a heart attack 4 years ago. They gave me fentanyl. I'm very happy that they did. It's a wonderful, wonderful drug when used medically. But Janssen and many other people always understood that the reason it was so effective was because it was enormously potent. And so you had to very carefully control for supply. And so the first fentanyl initially was only supplied to anesthesiologists in operating rooms. That was the only place you could get it. And strangely enough, those were the first people to ever get addicted to fentanyl, were anesthesiologists. I spoke to one or two about this was back in the 70s. Since then, you've seen certain amateur, underground, anonymous chemists produce the stuff in the United States. But the real key turning point came in a story I tell in The Least of Us, which is a lab that starts up in Mexico in the city of Toluca, run by an underground a chemist who knows how to make it. He spent time in the United States, went to prison for fentanyl, gets out. Is deported to Mexico, the Mexican citizen is deported to Mexico, and the Sinaloa cartel fund a lab for him. They wanted to make ephedrine, which at the time was the method for making, the precursor for making meth. He thinks he's smarter than those guys. He says, yeah, well, you don't know. So he starts to make fentanyl. They find out, they're a little upset, but then he explains to them, this is the new thing. This is will give you profits you've never been able to achieve in with any other drug. And he was right. That was the first time. That was 2006. That lab was busted in 06. But it's the fentanyl that first got out was shipped to Chicago, Detroit, St. Louis, Philadelphia, and it began killing people. There was a 10-month or so period when it just killed lots and lots of people, the first kind of fentanyl die-off really in our country's history. It was busted, that fentanyl petered out and wasn't seen again. But the Mexican trafficking worlds, particularly in Sinaloa, never forgot fentanyl. And so when the Chinese began to sell it, they were a major customer through the mails again. But this is all the way, you know, it's fentanyl. It does not belong in the hands of traffickers. In the hands of traffickers, it becomes the disaster that we've seen. And of course, in the hands of dealers at the local level, it's a complete disaster. They don't know how to mix it. They can't sell it. You have to sell fentanyl mixed with other things because so little of it will get you high, and a little bit more than that will kill you. And so they mix it with other powders. For a while, they were mixing it in magic bullet blenders. That was the myth, that this is the best way to mix fentanyl, you know, with those things you get at Target for $29.95 and infomercials. It's a great little machine. I own one, but it's for mixing smoothies.
And I have one for my smoothies. Right. Exactly.
Magnificent for that, by the way.
Exactly. I should have had the smoothie this morning. I'm getting a little hungry now that you mention it. I mean, I'm wondering now too. I mean, how has that affected the market for pure heroin? Because I would imagine that heroin users are desperate to find something that isn't fentanyl, because despite the clear incentive for dealers to do it because it's so cheaper and easy to make, the pure stuff, it's probably becoming a bit of a rarity.
No, heroin is really fading out. It won't be around this on the streets of America in a couple of years. I don't believe. I suspect that will happen. You know, I was in a homeless encampment the other day in Nashville, and I was speaking with a guy who was a longtime heroin user, and he said this guy dropped by the camp like a week before, he told me, and with black tar heroin, real just straight up black tar heroin, and you know, nobody would buy it. He says, because, and he said, it wasn't going to do me any good because I'm addicted to fentanyl. People now are using fentanyl, and they may have not known initially what they were using, but now they're addicted to it. And like any opioid, it takes your tolerance up to a certain level, and you have to have that every day. Well, heroin is much weaker, as potent as heroin is, and it can be. It's much weaker than fentanyl. So there's no way that fentanyl is going to get rid or keep the dope sickness, the withdrawals and all, at bay. And so people now, like this fella, need fentanyl, you know, and it's that is the case. I'm finding that all over the country now, really. People have switched. People have at first were leery of fentanyl, and now a lot of folks are, people still are leery, of course. It's a dangerous thing, but it's what's happened now is that people are now addicted to it. And once you're addicted to it, you got to buy it every day. That's one of the reasons why people would, dealers on the street would mix fentanyl, because it's, again, the supply is so prevalent, plentiful, it's like salt, you know, would mix it into cocaine, because you boost your cocaine a little bit. And if after a while, that person who's buying your cocaine, thinking it's just straight cocaine, once it has fentanyl in it, now becomes a fentanyl addict. And that addict has to buy from you every single day, whereas cocaine, you might buy every week, every few days. That turns an occasional customer into a regular, very serious intent customer. And that's what you're finding on the streets of America today. The people are using levels of fentanyl that would have killed them 2 or 3 years ago, but their tolerance is much, much higher. And that's why heroin is almost worthless on the street in America today.
But like, I don't have the literacy, but cocaine alerts, you know, it's a stimulant, right? And fentanyl is a depressant.
It's a depressant.
Why would, and then we can also then turn to meth after this question, but I don't understand why a cocaine user would, or they would immediately notice, right? If there's,
I think a lot of them don't understand what's going on, and it doesn't take you long to all of a sudden need that stuff. And so a couple of purchases and you're pretty much right there. You know, you are now a fentanyl a user. And then there's this slippery slope that you begin to slide down into, and pretty soon it's, the cocaine isn't even the issue anymore. But dealers on the street have definitely found this to be the case. I would say this is the main reason now we're seeing rising deaths over the last 4 or 5 years, say, in the African American community due to opioids. When I was writing Dreamland, it was clear to me that the opioid epidemic was really just dramatically a white problem. I saw virtually no black people involved in it. But now what you're seeing is African Americans whose drug of choice in the drug using community is cocaine. They are using it and they're getting addicted to fentanyl, or what's actually happening is a lot of them just simply, they have, of course, no tolerance for this stuff. And so they very quickly die. So you're seeing this really real increase in African American opioid overdose deaths. But really, when you dig down deep into the numbers, just talking with coroners in Cleveland and Akron, this is where you first saw this phenomenon taking place. It's very clear that the people who are using it think they're using cocaine. That's what killed, for example, Michael K. Williams, a great actor who was in The Wire not long ago. He I'm sure thought he was using cocaine. He was, but there was in the cocaine, there was some fentanyl, and that's what I think killed him. So this is all part of the new normal, given the fact that we have synthetic drugs coming out of Mexico in the quantities that are just staggering.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, once rich Wall Street types see fentanyl in their cocaine, which is, widely recreationally used, that might change the game a little bit.
No, I think synthetic drugs have spelled the end to the concept of recreational drug use. That was a concept that is kind of old. It grew up in a time when the drugs were far more scarce, far more expensive, and far weaker, far more forgiving overall in general, you might say, than they are now. The truth is now there's no way of knowing, unless you buy a pill from a pharmacy and that pill comes in a bottle that you get from that pharmacy, there's almost no way of knowing that what you're going to using, even if you get it from a very trusted friend, that what you're using, it won't have fentanyl in it. It's all a one big, game of Russian roulette now, on the streets. Hence the enormous, numbers of overdose deaths that we've been seeing over this year and last year.
Yeah. I mean, there's part of me where you go, okay, well, if there's a way to decriminalize something like cocaine, maybe that allows for less of that, but we're dealing with such a scary wild, wild west with the synthetics that, I would not want to decriminalize those right now. Possession, yes, but those are...
Well, the problem is if nobody lasts on the street, there's no such thing as a long-term fentanyl user, and fentanyl is now in everything. And so there's this mix now that's really rare. It's never happened really in the widespread nature of it, where you're finding fentanyl and stimulants together, cocaine, methamphetamine, etc. So the truth is, anybody who has fentanyl is at risk of dying. Leaving people on the street, selling fentanyl is akin, in my opinion, I think the evidence is pretty clear on this, to firing a gun into a crowd. You are very, very likely to kill somebody and extremely likely to cause extraordinary damage to somebody and maybe a lot of people. With just possession, though, the problem is that if you're using that, you are going to die. That it's a death sentence. There's no... It's not like you have any reprieve, you know what I mean? And so I believe now this whole episode has really called into question the idea of whether it's a good idea to decriminalize these drugs. That's what we had. We had an experiment, drug decriminalization. That was what COVID was. It was unplanned. Nobody intended it. But essentially what it was saying, the jails were kicking people loose. Cops weren't arresting people for the kinds of, possession type stuff or even larger, like possession of stolen property or these kinds of things, because they didn't want people in the jail passing the coronavirus. So What that meant is, one of the effects of that is, I think, the overdose death numbers that we've seen. This is a new world. People need to understand that old ideas don't apply anymore. Recreational drug use is one of them. I think decriminalizing fentanyl or meth. Rather, what we need to do is we need to use arresting powers to get people off the street, not to get them into prison, but to begin their treatment. And this is, I think more and more jurisdictions are understanding that you leave people on the street, they're going to be dead. That's not like a debatable point anymore.
Well, there are trial programs in, say, something like Portugal that, you know, doesn't involve a criminalization element for possession. You can, there's a reallocation of funds for treatment, which I feel might be something closer to what you're advocating.
Yeah, I think all of that is worth trying. But the problem is this. It's an important point to understand that these drugs do not lend themselves to treatment. You will not get people on the street. Extraordinarily difficult, it's proving to be, to get people who were on the street under the governing power of these very potent drugs to just opt into treatment without being pushed.
Yeah. No.
You need some push. You need some leverage over these drugs. I was just speaking with a doctor in Texas, a psychiatrist at an ER, and she was saying that very thing. All these folks, you might get them into treatment for a couple of days, but they are so prone to just bolting and leaving against medical advice, that against staff advice, kind of thing. And once they're out on the street again, this is a deadly thing. This is not the drugs of, say, the even crack of the 1980s, which was awful, but you didn't die, you know. And then, of course, methamphetamine, which is kind of a deranging thing now, absolutely out of, people get out of their minds, and therefore also very difficult to get into treatment, because in order to have really successful treatment, you have to be able to have that human connection. And when you're paranoid and schizophrenic and, you know, the hallucinations and all this stuff, it just is very difficult to develop that rapport with a person in that condition.
Well, I mean, let's talk about meth then, because that was another, you know, big focus of your book. And I feel like most of the stories about meth that I heard were in 2005. And I think that, I mean, and then of course Breaking Bad brought that onto the scene nationally. But I mean, and it also was maybe kind of something that set the stage for the opioid epidemic, because it was hitting white communities pretty hard, which caused different kinds of media attention, as opposed to the crack cocaine epidemic. But what's different about meth this time around?
Well, meth this time around is made with a different way. It's no longer the chemical I referred to earlier, ephedrine, which is a decongestant you find in Sudafed pills and all the rest. That's a very easy thing to turn into methamphetamine, and the Mexican traffickers had industrialized that and made a lot of it. They never were really able to cover much. They covered a lot of the West, never got east of the Mississippi River, and then all of that changed. And this ephedrine meth was like a party drug. You know, it was all euphoric, big in the gay community, big in really. You want to be around people, a sociable kind of drug. It was not good for you. You decayed over periods of time. And you remember those mugshot posters of people over 6 or 7 years, you know, you'd see them transformed. But that's kind of what it was. This new stuff is very, very different. The effects of it are very, very different. Let's put it that way. This began in 08, really 09. The Mexican government outlawed ephedrine. Mexican traffickers switched to a new way of making, a more messy way, one that involves lots of different industrial, legal, toxic chemicals. And the precursor in that way of making it is known as P2P. So phenyl-2-propanone. You can make the benefit to traffickers of this method. There's only one of them, and that's very important. And that is that with P2P, you can make P2P many, many different ways with all kinds of different chemical, you know, hacks kind of. And so if you can find those chemicals, and they're widely available, they're used in all kinds of industries, you can make this stuff forever. And that's exactly what's happening. So you saw the march of this stuff really begin in 2009, but in 2010, 2011, but then really as the supplies really exploded, 2013, 14, it was really all over the West, all over certainly the West Coast. By 2016, 17, it was in the Midwest. And by 2019, it was up into New England, which never had any meth at all. And that remarkable thing, as I said, the coverage has been just dramatic all over the country. And at the same time, this is a stunning fact that even as they covered the entire country, the price of that product dropped by 80%. So they're covering it and the price dropped. But this meth has another part to the story that I only learned later as I was about to close to finishing The Least of Us. And that is that it brings with it, it's accompanied by very severe symptoms of schizophrenia, paranoia, severe paranoia, florid hallucinations of all kinds and delusions. And very quickly, of course, people are incapable of being around others. If ephedrine meth was a social drug, this one is more like an enclosing drug. You kind of enclose into your own mind, which is all of a sudden developing all these bizarre ideas about what's around you. Very quickly, you fall into homelessness. You can't really stay in a homeless shelter because the shelters are terrifying because everyone's scaring the hell out of you. You're paranoid about everybody. And so this has also led to the street homelessness, the tents. I believe are closely connected to this kind of methamphetamine. The tents are perfect lodging for someone who views the world as just constantly full of threats and scary monsters. So if you're all alone in your tent, you can be alone and kind of away from the scary world that meth has created in your mind. So as this has marched across the country, you see tent encampments, homelessness, and mental illness rising along with that in areas also that never had homelessness before, rural areas with no problems of affordable housing. There's the Rust Belt towns and that kind of thing. And so this is part of what's going on in America today, due largely, I would say, due intensely to this this massive quantity of this one synthetic drug that's able to be produced down in Mexico now.
So that's really the parallel here with fentanyl here, is that like the I don't want to say the democratization of the production, but the democratization of the production also has lended to cheaper but more extreme production standards that have created drugs that are, you know.
Absolutely. I would say that's exactly right. That's exactly right. That's what's happened. It's, you know, you've got all kinds people. We think of the groups down in Mexico as cartels. They're not cartels. Economists will tell you a cartel is something that is a group that forms to constrict production to force price up. The opposite is happening here. It's a total glut economy. And that is because they're really not cartels, except for in some ways, that kind of when it comes to defense and violence, that maybe there's some kind of unity. But really, on the ground, when it comes to production, anybody can make this stuff, so long as you kind of pay a little tribute to the people who are kind of the more serious actors in your region, that kind of thing. No, this is a lot, many, many, many people. Now, a lot of people who have come from the marijuana world, where now we're legalizing marijuana, so they can't make the revenue that they're used to making with marijuana. And so meth has kind of emerged as a substitute for that. So a lot of people move into that. But then a lot of people, you know, the methods are very easy very well known. Down in some of these regions, again, the chemicals coming into Mexico are just scandalous. They're just stunning, and so more and more people are making it, and hence the price has dropped. This is not like the economist version of what a cartel is, and the glut of these two drugs is kind of proof of that.
Well, Sam Quiñones, his book is called The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. You spoke to so many people in this book. I'd encourage everybody to read it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Emma. Sam,
really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Emma. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yes, of course. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, wrap up the first hour of The Majority Report. We are back. We had somebody write in, KY Nick, as a former heroin addict from Cincinnati, when I was using in 2014, you could drive to gas stations in the city and get free, quote, tester bags from dealers. Supply is definitely not an issue anymore. Yeah, that's nuts. All right, let's touch a little bit on what happened yesterday with Paul Gosar. So, for people who aren't aware, Representative Paul Gosar, who now has at least two siblings of, I think he has two others who may not be speaking publicly about him, but two's enough. They are calling him a maniac, unstable, a variety of different things that should probably set off alarm bells for people. But he is still in the House of Representatives, although yesterday he was formally censured, mostly along party lines. There were two Republicans that joined to censure him, on the video that he tweeted out, which was an Attack on Titan parody of him looking like he was killing AOC and assaulting Joe Biden. Now, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez spoke on the House floor during the censure vote, and she spoke about the nihilism of the Republican Party in a way that I haven't heard a representative speak about these themes really ever. And I think she encapsulated a lot of the psychology and the philosophy of how Republicans operate right now.
Not just the Republican, but I have seen other members of this party advance the argument, including Representative Gosar himself, the illusion that this was just a joke. That what we say and what we do does not matter so long as we claim a lack of meaning. Now, this nihilism runs deep. And it conveys and betrays a certain contempt for the meaning and importance of our work here. That what we do so long as we claim that it is a joke doesn't matter. That what we say here doesn't matter. That our actions every day as elected leaders in the United States of America doesn't matter. That this chamber and what happens in it doesn't matter. And I am here to rise to say that it does. Our work here matters. Our example matters. There is meaning in our service. And as leaders in this country, when we incite violence with depictions against our colleagues, that trickles down into violence in this country. And that is where we must draw the line, independent of party, identity, or belief. It is about a core recognition of human dignity and value and worth. So when we talk about, as mentioned in the resolution, that these depictions are part of a larger trend of misogyny and racial misogyny, racist misogyny. This has results in dampening the participation.
Yeah, I mean, there is meaning in governance. The Republican Party is the anti-government party, and they've made that clear for history. Small government's one version of it, but then it's just they're against doing anything for people. It's indicative in their actions. They serve as stewards for the financial industry, for capitalists. They view their function as dismantling government, and so it should not be a surprise to anybody that they view their role within government with like a joker-fied nihilism. And so she points all of that out there. She focused on their words and their actions and things like, you know, tweeting out a violent video depicting the assault and killing of government officials of opposing parties. But the quote that stuck out to me, and there were two, when she said, "There is meaning in our service," because there should be. But because of the way that we've structured our, say, campaign finance system, for example, it incentivizes one side of the political spectrum in the Republicans to see their service as destroying the limiting powers of a government on the very capitalists that fund them. And so this is an entire troll job. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is the number one grassroots fundraiser in the Republican Party, and that's her value to them. And she has no committee assignments. She's unable to do anything except maybe a speech or two or a media appearance. But that's sufficient. That's sufficient for her constituents and for the people that support her, because they do not want her there to govern. They do not want dignity in service. The Republicans are defined by their dismantling of government. And so, you know, for a lot of the people that support them, the trolling is enough because they find some visceral release in that. And the fact that they're using that to obscure what they're actually doing and helping the richest of us all, that's fine because, you know, the base got their emotional release. But this is just like how this has always been the Republican Party. It's just now it's more naked, and they're able to kind of artistically express it via social media, I guess, and accelerate it.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's fully detached from policy. The thing I feel for Ghosts are because a lot of these people, they basically run daycares for sort of rancid little Nazis. That's what their staff is, like Matt Gaetz and all those. And this goes for also Tucker Carlson. And it's more fun to talk about this. This is why Laura Ingraham did the whole joke thing with the You. I was watching You. What show were you watching? Because like this sort of, like you say, like trolling BS is really all that the content they need, because they're just filling a hole. I mean, and it's not just the, like, service should have meaning, right? Joe Manchin is right now thinking of some complete bullshit to tell America so that he doesn't have to include a family leave, right? Like, so, like, we're at a situation now where meaning has been ripped from democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an aspiration that that has meaning, but it's going to take a lot of effort to make it meaningful again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All right, folks, we are going to head into the fun half. I'm seeing some of the comments criticizing some of the solutions advocated by Sam there, our author here. I understand that. Again, like, you know,
we'll get into some of that.
We can get into some of that in the fun half. Brandon, hello.
Hello.
Good to see you. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And yourself?
I'm doing all right. What's happening over on the discourse?
Well, we have a new episode out for patrons over on the Patreon entitled Secret President Mitt Romney, where my, you know, I want to say lovely co-host extols his newest conspiracy theory that Mitt Romney has secretly been president since 2008. I'm sorry, 2012.
That's beautiful. I would love to hear more about that. Matt, Left Reckoning was last night, was it not?
Yeah, we had a full show last night. First, William Shockey of Africa is a Country to talk about the of Frederick Willem de Klerk and how he should not be credited with ending apartheid like the New York Times did for him. We also talked to Jacob from the Val Labor Reporters about the stuff going on with Warrior Met and their attack on free speech there, and how BlackRock and the other major multinational corporations that are putting the money behind it why it's kind of scary that they don't seem to be acting like they're losing maybe close to $400 million on the slow production, and what it means for, like, you know, when giant investors can come in and just float strike busting. It's a pretty scary situation. And in the post game, we talked about the little bit of good news in the success with John Deere. We also talked about the Ben Shapiro, Stephen Jay Gould IQ stuff. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. Go check out that show, folks.
Oh, you covered the gambit. Binder, hello.
Hello. How are y'all doing?
Doing well. What's happening over on Doomed?
Well, over on Doomed, this past Tuesday, which is now uploaded, the main segment is now uploaded to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/MattBinder, but I went live on Tuesday on Twitch, twitch.tv/MattBinder, and I broke down that Jimmy Dore segment on the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and how apparently the mainstream media completely failed everyone. Because Jimmy Dore didn't pay much attention to the case, and he had originally thought that the people Kyle Rittenhouse shot were black. And that's apparently mainstream media's fault, that he didn't, you know, click a link and look at the pictures of the people that
I
thought these guys were black.
Yeah.
But that's what all these guys are saying, because none of them paid attention to this case. None of them cared enough to pay attention. So they think that because they didn't do the work of clicking a link, mainstream media failed them.
Well, all that they're interested in is branding themselves as opposed to mainstream media anyway.
It's all about like how the liberal media just wants you to think thought police. Like, of course, these guys weren't even black. Like, they want to tell you he's a racist. He didn't even kill black people.
Right. Which is the necessary part of him going down to a Black Lives Matter rally, protest, whatever you want to call it, with a rifle in order to protect property. That's, you know, that has nothing to do with the race of those people, even though there's a video of him that the judge wouldn't allow to be shown at the trial. But there's a video of him from earlier, not that day, but early days before. He posted a video where he saw like someone shoplifting from a store who was black, and he said how much he wished he could shoot someone like that.
That's just patriotism right there. I don't know.
You know, I was actually thinking about something similar, not the Jimmy Dore thing, but like, we do have a problem, I think, with people in not the media broadly speaking, but the way we characterize white supremacist violence or violence in the name of like white supremacy or whatever nebulous concept that it's being branded as today, as being something that is uniquely targeted towards the black community in such a way that's going to become cordoned there. And so like, even if you thought that the like victims were inherently black because that's the, you know, mindset you were in, that really says, I think, more about the way in which we're, you know, we're kept from the reality that white supremacist violence is oftentimes the underlying, you know, along with misogynist violence, the underlying ideology of the mass shooters that we see who kill people indiscriminately in this country.
Mm-hmm. Right. Absolutely.
But, you know, yeah. I think is kept from us for reasons that is unrelated to whatever they were talking about, because it's like, well, yeah, if people knew that about white supremacy, they might feel a little bit less like it's a problem for other people and more like it's just generally a problem for everybody.
Yeah.
Right. So in that segment, Jimmy Dore had on as his guest to walk him through everything, because again, Jimmy's not, doesn't know the subject very well. Matt Orafalia, whatever. I forget, the guy who got fired from the Bernie campaign, literally like the day he was hired, because he created some video in his past that came out that did not, you know, not a good look.
Weird hiring choices by the Bernie campaign in 2020.
So he was in that segment. But he was in that segment, and he's reached out to me now, and it looks like we are going to have a discussion about the case. That is not tonight, though. That's in the coming days. Tonight, though, Natalie Shore will be joining me at youtube.com/MattBinder and on twitch.tv/MattBinder to discuss the very real Havana Syndrome, which by very real, we mean probably not very real at all.
Yeah, she's been doing some great writing on that. I'm excited for that episode.
Honestly, I thought Havana Syndrome was when you get that thing in your, that song in your head, and you can't not automatically go ooh na na when you hear the word Havana. That's Havana Syndrome to me.
Are you, now you got it stuck in my head, so thank you for infecting me with your Havana Syndrome.
I thought you meant the song like Copacabana.
That's
oh,
new.
No, no.
I didn't mean that song.
I'm talking that song. Yes. Is it Camille Cabello or whatever her name is? That
yes.
who it is?
Yes. Yeah. But the Barry Manilow Copacabana one might even be more earwormy. So I'll decide which one's going to torture me for the next 24 hours. After our break, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.